Kansas City's freeway system is one of the most extensive in the world. We also know about our cultural ethos, jazz, barbecue, of course, with a town history and heritage that are rich. But how often do we stop to reflect on the four elements, earth, wind, fire, and water, and how they affect our city's past, present, and future? Here's a hint. A river runs through it. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, an update on the Missouri River cleanup and levee repair from officials from the Army Corps of Engineers. They're going to drop by to tell us why what's good for the Missouri River is good for the Mississippi River, and so on and so forth in our local, regional, and national natural world. That plus a look at another element of nature in the city, the Green Impact Zone on the city's east side. That's on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. City, perhaps two of the most definitive features of Kansas City are its two rivers and the east-west socioeconomic and racial divide beginning at Troost Avenue. Today we'll be talking with individuals who are instrumental in shaping both of those phenomena. The east side of Kansas City is known for many things: palatial craft homes, historic sites, churches next to liquor stores, and vacant lots that are so full of rich natural vegetation. Where some see blight, others see might. In other words, might. Words of potential strength and possibility. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our discussion begins with an update on what's happening inside the so-called Green Impact Zone between Troost Avenue and Prospect on the west and east boundaries and 39th Street and 51st Streets on the north and south boundaries, respectively. Kansas City, what do you deem the most pressing environmental concern in your neighborhood? Do you live in the Green Impact Zone between Troost and Prospect Avenues? Have you been to this area? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and Twitter at KCURCST. You can also hit us up there as well. We'd now like to welcome our guest, beginning with Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver II, joining us from Washington, D.C. Congressman Cleaver, welcome to Central Standard.
Good to be with you.
We also have Anita Maltbia, Executive Director of the Green Impact Zone, and Margaret May, Executive Director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association. Anita, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good morning.
And Ms. Margaret May, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Congressman Cleaver, how did this zone come about? Give us a refresher course.
Well, when it became obvious that we were going to successfully move the so-called stimulus bill through Congress, I began to think about ways in which we could reverse what we've traditionally done in Kansas City, and that is, because we have six councilmatic districts, every time monies come into the city, we make the decision to divide it by six. I'm the person who introduced the legislation to create what we call PIAC now, the Public Improvement Advisory Committee. And one of the things that that committee does is to divide things by six. Actually, it's seven because there's a, something called a citywide pot. I did it again when I introduced the same kind of legislation for the Neighborhood Tourism Program, NTDF. And what happens when we do that is we assume that all parts of the city are equally suffering and in equal need for attention. The truth of the matter is when one finger on our hand is hurt or damaged, there is an automatic signal sent from the brain to protect it. And so even unconsciously, we would shield the hurt finger by the other fingers. And that's what I came to realize was needed in our community. So instead of trying to get stimulus dollars and scatter them all over the city, and after which nobody would ever remember what was done or could even see any improvements, all you have to do is think back to the Model Cities program. Of all the money spent in the Model Cities program, there's only one institution remaining from Model Cities days, and that's the Swope Park Health Center. So I said, let's get an area. We got the, an area bounded by Troost on the west, 39th Street on the north, 51st Street on the south, and then going to the Bruce R. Watkins. And we thought because there was an emphasis on ecological development, that we would try to green this area in a way that was superior to any other urban area, not only in the United States, but in the world. And then we went after those dollars, and we were successful in getting it and successful in getting the services of Anita Maltbia, who was pleasantly enjoying her retirement.
And Congressman, we're going to bring Anita Maltbia in here in just a minute. But a follow-up question, were you following any examples, having been around the country, being a congressman, were you following examples in other municipalities as a new way of attempting neighborhood revitalization, or was this strictly seen from the needs of your native Kansas City?
Yeah, fortunately or unfortunately, I guess I should say, there were no examples. And even today, there are no examples with the kind of ubiquitous move that we've made. In fact, we're having city officials come to Kansas City to look at the Green Impact Zone in hopes of trying to duplicate such a project in their hometowns.
And we'll talk to the person on the ground here, the people on the ground here, beginning with Anita Maltbia, Executive Director of the Green Impact Zone. An approximate 1,000 vacant lots, 600 lots of disuse, according to the latest figures. Where do you even start, Ms. Maltbia? Where do you start?
Well, we started where an initiative like this should definitely start, and it's with the people themselves. And so before I was hired even, the Mid-America Regional Council, which is the organization in which this initiative is housed, went out to the five neighborhoods that make up the Green Impact Zone, asked for their leadership to convene, and worked with them over a 2 or 3 month period to craft the vision. And that is where something like this should always start. It has continued to be that way.
And it does start in the neighborhoods. Ms. Margaret May, Executive Director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association, what are you seeing on the corner, literally, on the street level?
Well, we've seen a great deal of progress made, but when you have a problem like we've experienced in the center city, 35, 40 years of disinvestment, with 3 years or less of an initiative targeting the area, I don't know how we could think that in that short of time we could solve the problem. But we have made a lot of progress in the short period of time.
The project is still waiting on city funds.
That is correct.
And
our funding from anyone else. We're not going to discriminate. We'd love to have funding.
Congressman Cleaver, can you address the sort of continuation of that? An idea begins and it starts as a seed, but it definitely needs water, liquidity, so to speak. Can you address that?
Sure. I mean, I have about five big ideas a month, and 3 or 4 months worth of ideas, I'll usually get something that works, and this worked. And what I think it's important for the listeners to know that the funds for doing the actual work came from the federal government, from a number of federal agencies. But the money to run the Green Impact Zone office came from the city of Kansas City, Missouri. And so the city funds that operation, and the funds to like we're doing curbs and sidewalks right now. We've done improvements along Brush Creek at Troost, including building a new bridge at 51st Street. Those funds came from either the Department of Transportation, a Tiger Grant, or in case of the solar panels on top of Paseo High School, Department of Energy, and it goes it runs the gamut of federal agencies.
So as the stimulus peters out, or as the stimulus stops where it stops, now the onus is on the city. And what's happening there, Anita Maltbia?
Well, as the congressman has said, our core operation, having people who show up every day and work multiple hours a week in conjunction with the neighborhoods, that function has been funded by the city of Kansas City. And we understand that a city has a huge area to be responsible for. What we've requested is enough funding to give us more headroom to pursue other avenues of funding. And we are hoping to see that come to fruition.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. We're catching up on the latest activity in the Green Impact Zone of Kansas City's East Side. Our guests are Anita Mountbia, Executive Director of the Green Impact Zone, and Margaret May, Executive Director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association. And we also have with us Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver II, joining us from Washington, D.C. Congressman Cleaver will only be with us for a little while longer, but we're going to go to the phones right now to Bill on Troost Avenue. Welcome to Central Standard, Bill.
Good day. How are you all?
All right. Go ahead.
Good. I reside on Troost. I'm a member of the Mannheim Neighborhood Association. Mannheim Neighborhood is completely contained within the Green Impact Zone. It is also where most of the infrastructure construction has been going on, as well as the infamous tree cutting episode that I think everybody knows about.
Okay.
My question is relating to one of the mandates, which are called the Green Impact Zone strategies. Why the Green Impact Zone exists is to do infrastructure. The Tiger Grant is the federal money. I'm all about building up our infrastructure. I am for development. I am for ecological development and sustainable development, which I do not believe the Green Impact Zone is doing.
What is your question? We're very short on time here.
My question is, what proofs, what results of green infrastructure can you show other than a few test pilot half-block areas where you've used sustainable building materials to create infrastructure that is really green? There's nothing green about the sidewalks you have now done for us. They are 1950s sidewalks, poured concrete. There's nothing permeable about it. Your test project is about a half a block of total area. Meanwhile, our complete rest of our neighborhood has been decimated.
Well, Bill,
please comment on that.
Yes, I'll give you a chance to comment. Congressman Cleaver, answer his question.
First and foremost, I think a lot of the people who live in the Green Impact Zone would not only disagree with the gentleman, but they would be offended by what he said, particularly people who are in homes with new furnaces and smart meters, which will allow them to control what their electric bills will be. I think the people who are benefiting from a reduction in crime in that area, we have established, we put up something called a shot spotter, which places sensors on the tops of buildings and structures, so that if a gun is fired within 10 seconds, the police will know exactly the place where the gun was fired. And it goes on and on. And it's being done in a green way. Everything we're doing is done to enhance green. The key word that the gentleman used earlier, he said, building sidewalks for us. That's a direct quote, if you play it back, for us. And one of the tragedies in Kansas City is that people don't like to do things because they know that no matter what they do, somebody's going to attack it, no matter how many people benefit from it. Somebody's going to attack it. I'm the only member of Congress who used stimulus dollars to create a local project. Most members of Congress don't even want to be involved in it. They want to get the money, vote on it, and leave it alone. Let communities come out. We've spent over $125 million in that 75-block area.
To be fair to Bill, Anita Mountbia, the NIMBY, the omnipresent, not in my backyard thing, goes both ways. Somebody might say, you're not building this in my backyard, and others might say, as Bill just espoused, as he called in the Central Standard, why not in my backyard? So address what Bill's concerns are, because they're a truth to him.
Well, I think that the caller has a very limited perspective and speaks as one who is newly arrived to the community and has a specific goal in mind. One of the things that's real important to know is that when the neighborhood leaders were brought together, the vision that they crafted was one that dealt with quality of life. So the neighborhoods are very clear that while the foundation of the Green Impact Zone is energy efficiency and environmental conservation, the overarching vision is quality of life. And for anyone who has lived in the urban core for any period of time, you know the state of sidewalks and curbs. Where my office is, I have two windows. And prior to the new sidewalks being put in, I saw people constantly having to walk in the street, baby carriages being pushed in the street. We had testimony from elderly folk that they didn't like to get out because they were afraid of stumbling and falling because of the cracked and upheaved sidewalks. Children could not ride their tricycles on the sidewalks because it was just too broken and uneven. So we speak of green in its broadest sense. We're talking about revival. We're talking about verdancy. We're talking about a broader spectrum, even as we are being extremely respectful of our physical environment, our natural environment, and also as we seek to make whatever improvements be more energy efficient. So I think that the caller's vision and his viewpoint is very narrow, fairly self-centered, and not on point with what the overall mission of the Green Impact Zone is.
We're going to go to Margaret May in just a second. Congressman Cleaver, we know that you have to go. We know you're a U.S. congressman. So do you have any closing thoughts on what the Green Impact Zone should be experiencing going forward? And then we'll go back to Margaret May, who's actually there, actually lives there.
She actually lives there. She actually runs a neighborhood organization that's been one of the most successful neighborhood organizations, I think, in the state, maybe the country. Finally, let me just say, we're up here, unfortunately, trying to keep the country from collapsing economically. But I think that we've done something in Kansas City that is the envy of the entire Congress, 434 other members. And we've been able to save the city hundreds of thousands of dollars. For example, the bridge on Troost, instead of those coming out of municipal dollars, they came out of the money we were able to get from the DOT. Curbs and sidewalks along Troost, all the way up Troost, they are brand new. We have work on Brush Creek that needed to be done around 51st and Troost. That people can see if they're in their cars and driving by there. We've been able to do curbs and sidewalks over in the communities that people who don't live there can't see. I talked about the shot spotter. I talked about the solar panels. I talked about the furnaces in people's homes. I have not spoken too much about the weatherization that took place that allows people to live in a house where most of the energy stays in the house instead of going through the windows and under the doors. We have been able to get acquire a number of foreclosed properties. We've been able to stabilize them in some instances, like over in Santa Fe, in Ivanhoe. They've been able to actually create livable properties that would have otherwise been abandoned, and people are moving in. So, and it goes on and on and on, and we're not through yet, and we'll probably have some announcements to make in a couple of weeks about some things that we are working on right now that will take it to an entirely new level.
Well, Congressman Cleaver, we'll let you go tackle that fiscal cliff and that upcoming debt ceiling debate, and thank you for joining us today on Central Standard.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Let's go now to Margaret May, Executive Director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association. What are the pluses and minuses of the Green Impact Zone as it stands right now?
Well, it's been a great benefit to the neighborhoods that are a part of the zone, Town Fork Creek and Troostwood, Blue Hills, Ivanhoe. We are excited to be a part of it. And it's so sad that people within the city are in some instances, having difficulty seeing the benefits and appreciating the value that the zone has. While across the nation, Anita and I have gone to a number of cities that we've been asked to talk about the zone, and people in other cities are very excited about it. To quickly talk about the residents in Ivanhoe, I do not live in Ivanhoe, but I work there 70, 80 hours a week, so maybe someone could say I'm there enough to say I live there too. One of our residents was having heating bills in the winter in excess of $300 a month. Due to her home being weatherized, her first bill that she got in the winter was $109. Now, that's a great benefit. We have residents that have participated in the leadership training classes. They're excited about them, and they've become much more active in our neighborhood. When you have informed people, people that have received training, who know how to go about building capacity, that's how you get a stronger neighborhood. We need more and more of that.
Now the cons. What still needs to be done?
Well, again, we have 35 or 40 years of disinvestment. So there's no way in 3 years it's going to all be done. We need more curbs and sidewalks throughout the entire zone. Right now, they're being done in certain targeted places. We need housing on the lots. We need the vacant houses, a number of them, to be acquired and rehabbed. Jobs, economic development, you name it, we still have needs, and we want to continue with this initiative to make sure that we can hit a home run.
You do still have needs, including ideological differences in the Green Impact Zone. Our friend Bill writes back in to say that he's a member of his own neighborhood association. I make no presumptions. He talked about the Mannheim area. Feels attacked by you, Anita. And Franny Knight tweets, the Green Impact Zone has not really accomplished much, quote unquote, green. 16 homes weatherized out of 600 is not much for $51 million. What is the role of the diversity of views, the role of gentrification in attracting diverse residents and diverse opinions, and talking about the use of the money in the Green Impact Zone, Anita Mabia?
Okay. Well, it really is important, especially when people put themselves in a leadership position, to be factual. To have a real understanding. And there are some people who have not bothered to come and learn from the source what the situation is, what the real numbers are, what the accomplishments are, what the issues are. And yet,
What are the issues? And how does this further, how does this Green Impact Zone in any way attempt to address the omnipresent question of the racial and socioeconomic divide that I kind of believe and have observed feeds these issues of false information, misinformation, and faulty communication between people who don't live in the neighborhood or people who are new to the neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you have to be willing to collaborate. You have to be willing to sit down and discuss. You have to deal from facts and not your opinion. And the five neighborhoods and their leadership have been very collaborative. It has been very rewarding to us to be a part of five neighborhoods, all of whom were already organized, all of whom had recognized neighborhood associations, who have been willing to come together, and the neighborhood leaders meet every month. It has been disturbing for folk to approach the Green Impact Zone as if it were a virgin forest rather than a place where people have lived and persevered for the last three or four decades in a state of disinvestment, and to decide that they know best, and to decide that their agenda is the one. So we do suffer in some ways from that kind of mentality.
And addressing the numbers, Ms. Margaret May, the funding that you're still waiting on from the city, and to a larger level, the funding that comes from many sources, public and private, is the fundamental issue how that money gets allocated and which projects get priority. Is that the fundamental issue?
Well, I think that the neighborhood leaders have set some priorities, and we're ready to go bring the funding.
Right. What are the priorities, Anita?
Well, you know, the from the vision, there were 8 strategies. And then about a year and a half ago, we polled the neighborhood leaders again and asked them, of those 8, which ones rise to the very top for you? And so while we've not let go of any of them, the 3 that rose to the top were housing, human capital, which includes job preparation and acquisition, and public safety.
And these are big, round concepts.
These are big, round concepts.
So how do they get implemented?
Well, you know, anyone who is really familiar with housing redevelopment, and then you have to add to that housing redevelopment in an area of disinvestment, knows that it is not unusual for it to take literally years to go from the planning stage to something that's actually standing there in brick and mortar. And we are pleased to say that there are several things that are in stages of development, some actually physical development right now, and within a 2-year period.
So, Margaret May, lastly, how do we keep from waving our green pom-poms about the green impact zone and losing sight of what could take a long time? How do we stay on the course?
Well, we've mentioned funding over and over and over again, and we need more and more people to be involved. And while it may make things a little uncomfortable having the divergent views, I'm one that says we need everyone to be involved, to listen to one another, so that we can continue moving forward.
And you're talking about public-private funding, public and private funding.
We need funding, public and private, yes. And if there's any other category of funding, we need that too.
We're catching up on the latest activity and challenges in the Green Impact Zone of Kansas City's East Side, a subject we will be revisiting here on Central Standard. Our guests are Anita Mautbia, Executive Director of the Green Impact Zone. Thank you for coming, Anita.
Thank you.
Margaret May of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association. She's the Executive Director there. Ms. Margaret May, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And we once again thank Congressman Emanuel Cleaver II for joining us earlier to talk about the federal angle. Thank you all for coming once again. When we return from a break, we get an update on the Missouri River levee repair and uncover the competing priorities to dictate water management. Central Standard returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. From the south and on the western approach into Kansas City, Missouri, the Missouri River from the air looks like a large liquid belt snaking through the landscape. The roads like smaller straps, zippers even, as a sort of topographical apparel for the beige, sun-drenched land below. I saw this sight recently as I descended into the Kansas City airport. Never for one moment, though, did I occur that I was looking at the longest river in North America. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and today we explore our environmental connections, the wide views from our local vantage. Joining us is Colonel Anthony J. Hoffman, commander of the Kansas City District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Welcome back, Colonel Hoffman.
Thanks, Jabalani. A pleasure to be here. Happy holidays to you and your listeners.
And Judd Knieven, Chief Emergency Management for the Army Corps of Engineers as well.
Good morning. It's good to be with you again.
Welcome back to the show. Now, tell us about the latest, Colonel Hoffman. And starting off, you did some recent work for Hurricane Sandy as well. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll come back home.
Okay, sure, Jabalani. I think it's important to note the Army Corps of Engineers, will talk more about this, but 3 major programs, Civil Works, Military, and Environmental, and then there's an emergency management component, which in conjunction with the National Response Framework and the Federal Emergency Management Agency will get called in under presidential declarations, et cetera, which is what we were. Both Judd and I deployed to Sandy. And quite frankly, the Corps of Engineers did some great work for the citizens of New York and New Jersey. In particular, power generation at key nodes, dewatering, unwatering efforts in 14 tunnels like the Holland Tunnel. And the power generation mission was for hospitals, wastewater treatment plants, et cetera. And then we have planning and response teams for debris, power generation, blue roofs, housing, et cetera. Judd, do you want to talk a little bit more about your experience there as well?
It was my first time to New York City, so it was, you know, the small farm boy in the big town. And I'll tell you what struck me most was population density, you know, and disasters. You just can't imagine what a storm like that can do to an area where the population is so dense. And you saw it in the high rises without power. When they go without power, they lose water because the water has to pump to the top of the building, and then it gravity feeds to the residents. So they were in a bind, and the businesses don't open. It was literally taking us 2 hours a day just to get to work, and then it would take us 2 hours to get home at night. So it was a major operation. You know, I was fortunate to be there prior to the landfall of the storm. I was there the night that the water poured back into the World Trade Center site. So it was quite an experience for me. You can't say enough about all the folks that responded, not just the Corps of Engineers, but FEMA and the other response agencies and organizations that are helping out.
When you talk about the East and Hudson Rivers and the adjacent Atlantic Ocean, there's a lot to consider. And most of our civilizations, Colonel Hoffman, have been settled on rivers, and rivers remain a concern. Coming back home, where are we with Missouri River cleanup and levees? What's the progress from last year when you guys joined us in the studio?
Right. Last August, we talked about that, Jabulani. Where we are, our number one priority in the district was to repair the Missouri River system. And I think we've done a very good job of that. I think the stakeholders would tell you that. With respect to levee repairs, we've had about $22 million worth of repairs. 29 of 30 contracts are in place. And the system, all of the levels of protection have been restored to the system. It's been very, very positive from that perspective. And frankly, the Disaster Relief and Appropriations Act, which was passed by Congress as a supplemental on the 23rd of December 2011, was instrumental. Likewise, we give a lot of credit not only to the federal agencies, but our local stakeholders. Our levy sponsors have been phenomenal in getting real estate easements for us, because we can't do it alone. And the local contractors that have been involved have been phenomenal as well. So right now, going very well with respect to levee repairs.
And Judd, there were plans, as Colonel Hoffman just talked about, to fix 11 of the 68 levees on the Missouri River. Did those plans come together?
Yeah, almost. We did a very good job. We had 57 requests for assistance. That was 57 separate levee systems. And of those, we ended up repairing 48. The others, they didn't meet the eligibility requirements, or the sponsors decided to proceed on their own. But we've done a very good job. And as the commander alluded to, our sponsors are a big part of that. I'm the guy out there all the time saying I think we have the best levee sponsors in the United States, and they show it time and time again in how they work with us.
Levy sponsors, let's clarify that, because this is a plethora and a cacophony of public and private levees along the stretch of Missouri River.
It sure is, Jabulani. As we talked about before, we've got both non-federal levee systems and federal. Federal were built by the federal government to a 100-year standard, and then are managed by the local levee sponsors. The non-federal system is not built by the federal, and they're built to a lower standard, frankly. And we only manage levees in the Public Law 8499 program. So it is a cacophony of a variety of federal, non-federal sponsors, and we are playing an instrumental role along with those sponsors.
But the plus and minus of that is maintaining the levees under your mandate really depends on how the private levees are maintained because of the flow of the river.
Absolutely. And under the Public Law 8499 program, we've got a pretty stringent system. And as Judd alluded to, those levee sponsors have done a phenomenal job of keeping those levee systems in accordance with the Public Law 8499 program.
We're speaking now after a very mild winter, and it was nearly non-existent, and after a very hot, dry drought, the hottest July on record. How does this change challenges for the river flow, the stage levels, and potential flooding and drying up and everything else?
Yeah, variety of challenges, and it's a 180 from last year. Mother Nature always has a vote, as you know, Jabulani, and in the Missouri River Basin in particular. You know, the drought, we're in current drought situation, and I guess, you know, one of the things I think that's important for the listeners to know is this is not just this area. It's not localized. There are pockets nationally of drought, whether it's the Mississippi River, the Ohio River, Lake Superior, et cetera. We've got kind of a national issue going on right now. And I'd leave you with really three key points with respect to the management. One, the central U.S. is suffering from an extended period of drought here, and it's predicted to persist well into the spring. And this can only be addressed as a long-term campaign, to use a military phrase. This is not something to be done short duration, because short duration management techniques may have some pretty severe impacts long term. A second key point is, as noted, extreme drought conditions across the Midwest and Central Plains have already impacted storage in the Missouri River reservoir system. We have a plan for a 12-year drought. That's what the system is managed to. And based on the current forecast information, right now 20% of that storage is already used in 1 year. So we're not in panic conditions, but with the conditions they are and the prediction for a pretty dry spring, we want to be very, very cautious on how we conserve that water. Third key point, droughts, as you know, in this area, not new to the Missouri River, and usually they're in multiple-year spans. There have been two recently extended droughts in the Missouri. One was 1987 to 1993, and 2000-2007. So there are patterns of extended droughts. So management of that conservation, that pool, is very important, taking it from a long-term campaign.
And he talks of long-term campaign, the colonel does. Judd, and even Chief of Emergency Management, what preemptive measures are being taken? This is a metro area beset by a history of droughts, by history of flooding. So what are the preemptive measures that are taken from an emergency management perspective?
Usually if you get into an extreme drought, you know, you'll have conservation measures put in place locally. One of the things, though, here that tempers that is because we do have the river system that we have, and a lot of municipalities, that's where they draw their water from. So we don't get in true water shortages per communities. It'll be for short stints. But over a prolonged period, that can have an effect. And one of the things that we'll be watching this winter, generally we reduce flows on the Missouri rivers, but we have to be very careful that we don't impact power plant intakes, municipality intakes. And so we're already on that watch. And the other thing we'll watch for is if it gets really cold, ice formation in the river can also have an effect on drawing down a low river even further, because as the water moves from one state, a liquid form, to a frozen form, it shrinks the volume. So those are some of the things that we're going to be watching for, and helping the local communities make sure that the water's in place for their use.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are Colonel Anthony J. Hoffman, commander of the Kansas City District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and Judd Knieven, Chief of Emergency Management. Kansas City, do you have questions about the river cleanup, levee maintenance, environmental concerns in your area, in your neck of the river? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. That's our email address. Or tweet us at KCURCST. We're going to go to Jeff up the river in Richmond. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi there.
Hello.
I'm a river junkie and love it very much, and have paid close attention to it for most of my adult life, which is many years now. And it is a matter of public record that with the passage of years, subsequent floods each reach higher peaks than the previous flood. And there's grounds to think that the levee construction and constriction of the rivers channel is what causes it. It used to be when it rained a lot, the river got wider, but now there is no wider, so it can only get deeper. And I'd be interested to know what the Corps is doing to change that 50-year-long management process in order to try to keep subsequent floods from getting higher.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for the question. How do you keep subsequent flows from getting higher?
Yeah, Jeff, a couple things on that. First, each flood event, not correcting you, but I appreciate your being a river junkie. I've become one just because of this job. But I guess a couple things. Each flood event is a little bit different. I'll use 2011 as an example here in the Kansas City area. 1993 was the record event in this particular reach of the river, yet 2011, really the system wasn't even challenged. So not all floods are getting astronomically worse, kind of as you alluded to. Each one's different and unique, and it really depends on what stage and what section of the river you're talking about. in terms of how are we looking at options to maybe make the river a bit more flexible and attenuable, I guess, if that's a word, and make it spread out, we have the Missouri River Recovery Program. And this is in conjunction with the damages, the environmental damages incurred with the bank stabilization navigation project that went in from 1912 to 1981. One aspect of the Missouri River Recovery Program is to take all 8 authorized purposes on the Missouri River, and those are flood control, navigation, hydropower, irrigation, water supply, water quality, fish and wildlife, and recreation, and to have certain tracts of land where there are pinch points on the river to allow the river to expand as necessary during flood events. And that's in conjunction. So the recovery program that we have mandated in accordance with the biological opinion does help all 8 authorized purposes work together in concert with each other, and that's one of the aspects of the recovery program. Judd, anything to add on that?
You talk about, perception of increased flooding and increased flood heights, and there is some truth in that, but like the commander said, it's every flood event's different. And one thing you have to remember on the Missouri River, most of the levee system's in place already. There's not a lot of new levees being constructed. The other thing is that they're all different heights, and most of the levee systems out there provide less than a 100-year level of protection, and because of that, they don't really influence those base flood elevations, and most of the events that we see are 5, 10, and 20-year events. So as we go through time, what we're measuring a more frequent, higher probability event against itself. We're not measuring it against events that occurred like in 1993 or that even occurred in 2011. So we have to very much distinguish that. The Corps does work with lots of agencies, though, to look for opportunities to reduce flood risk, not only along the Missouri River, but along their other major tributaries in both Missouri and Kansas. So keep that in mind also.
You're talking about rivers, lakes, and tributaries and bodies of water that are all connected geologically, ecologically. More water in the Missouri River, for instance, makes the Mississippi more navigable. The two are literally connected. How does the Missouri River management affect the larger ecosystem?
Sure. On the navigation aspect, in fact, with the Mississippi River being in drought conditions this year, Jebulani, the Missouri River actually had a full-service navigation season. And we define full-service navigation from 1 April to the first part of December, and to have a 9-foot by 300-foot channel for navigation, which we had this year. So no major issues with navigation on the Missouri River, but how that impacted the Mississippi River, where 60% of the flows allowed navigation to occur on the Mississippi River. So it was actually vital to have those flows from the Missouri to the Mississippi. Now, in the upper basin, the challenge is one of those other authorized purposes being recreation. So as that water's released, it can impact recreation. So our job really is to balance those authorized purposes, ensure that we provide the full service navigation season, which has enhanced navigation in the Mississippi River for this particular year. So that's always the challenge, is balancing those.
What are you doing in particular for the 500 miles your division is responsible for that helps all that, for lack of a better word, flow?
Right. Well, right now, we're operating the system in accordance with the master manual. The master manual went into place. It took a 14-year process, but we're watching the flows. Right now, the flows are going to increase out of Gavin's Point to 18,000 cubic feet per second here in the next few days due to the ice jams and the aspect that Judd already alluded to. But right now, we're operating within the master manual. The challenge will be if we don't get tributary inflows into those upper reservoirs or additional snowpack and peak snow, and they don't fill back up, we may have to take conservation measures in accordance with the master manual as well.
My middle son's name is Gavin, by the way. Tell us about Gavin's Point.
Well, Gavin's Point, one of the 6 main stem dams in the Missouri River. It's the southernmost, so really it's the one we watch closest. It's in the Omaha District's area of responsibility just north of rural Nebraska. And those flows impact, you know, the water levels here in the lower basin of the Missouri River. That's why it's very important to this region.
And we're watching for the ice storm because that could affect that.
Absolutely, and ice flows and how that works. So, but again, of the 6 main stem dams, Gavin's Point is the release point, the southernmost dam on the Missouri River. That's why we watch it closely.
We're going to Kevin in Mission, Kansas. Welcome to Central Standard, Kevin.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great show.
Thank you
very much. It's the Corps does a huge job, and it's undeniable and so forth. And it is tough, and it's tough to, you know, you can't go through a crystal ball and do this. However, back in the big snow that we had a few years ago and the consequent big floods in the spring, my brother lived by the river and was affected by the 93 flood and noticed that the snows in the Dakotas along the Missouri were already record highs in December. So he sent a letter to the head of the Corps, very formal, nice, polite, professional letter, saying, with all that record snows up there, perhaps they shouldn't be opening up the whatever they are, levees, dams, to let the water out so that we avert, you know, huge floods. And as it turned out, the floods, the levees, whatever they are, weren't opened until March. And it, so it's hard to come to any conclusion, but a great deal, some proportion of the, it seems that some proportion of the flooding then and the damage that occurred, it's hard not to come to the conclusion that a good bit of it wasn't on the hands of the Corps. Why wasn't there earlier reaction to that, frankly?
Thank you very much, Kevin. I believe he's referring to the Grand Forks.
Well, what he's, I think what Kevin's referring to is just, okay, you knew you had heavy snowfall in the upper reservoir. Why didn't you do releases right out of Gavin's Point earlier in the year? I can address that, a couple things. One, and the reservoir control system is managed in Omaha, Nebraska, by my division, or the Northwestern Division of the Army Corps of Engineers. But obviously, we play a role with the Omaha District and the two districts here in the Missouri River Basin. So let me address that. Yes, in fact, there's three types of precipitation that impact those reservoirs: peak snow, plain snow, and then precipitation. The peak snow and the plain snow, pretty easy to measure because it's typically on the ground. The game changer in the system in 2011 were record rains in Montana, Wyoming, and the Dakotas. For example, 8 to 16 inches of rain over one weekend in Montana, which was the amount of rain they get in a full year. That was not predicted by anybody, and that was the game changer in the system in 2011. And just to put 2011 into perspective, and these aren't excuses, Kevin. So you're right. I appreciate your comments on how challenging it is to manage the system. But the game changer were record rains in the May timeframe in 2011. To put the amount of runoff in the system in perspective, in the 114 years of record keeping on the Missouri River, the first, third, and fifth highest runoff in the history of the Missouri River Basin occurred in May, June, and July of 2011. And when you combine those 3 months of runoff, it is greater than the average amount of runoff for the 114-year history. So this was simply, not simply, but it was a magnitude event that hadn't been seen in the history since records have been kept. So, again, easy to measure snow, plain snow and peak snow, but not easy to determine when is the record rain going to come. And that was a game changer in the system in 2011, and water had to be released to the tune of 160,000 cubic feet per second out of Gavin's Point. Previous record there was 70,000. So 2.5 times the amount of release. So we didn't. So the Corps of Engineers and the public didn't lose a main stem dam due to the amount of water in the system.
So it's fair to say that if something happens in Grand Forks, North Dakota, or up in Montana, that definitely affects us down here, especially if it happens very disastrously.
Absolutely. It's an entire basin event, and rarely does that happen. In the 50s was the last time you had both an upper and lower basin flood event occur. So they don't occur often, but again, can't emphasize enough, the game changer in the system was the amount of precipitation in the May timeframe in Wyoming, Montana, and the Dakotas. Again, 8 to 16 inches of rain in Montana, nobody predicted that. So Kevin, great point, and I just wanted to point out the amount of runoff in the basin.
Tell us about the 18 lakes projects that affect your Missouri River work and our local waterways.
Sure. Local waterways here in Kansas City, the Kansas City District established in 1907, part of our civil works mission is not only the navigation or the bank stabilization navigation aspect, but we have 18 reservoirs that we're responsible for. Those reservoirs are key to local industry for recreation. They're key for flood damage reduction. And a lot of those lakes you've heard of, you know, Hillsdale, Longview, Clinton, Perry, and very important. And all of those systems went in place due to flood damage reduction. A lot of them are multiple congressionally authorized purposes, but they were put in place due to issues that occurred in the 40s, 50s, 30s, 40s, 50s due to prolonged floods. And then Congress authorized those projects to be in place to protect our citizens and to provide reservoir storage.
We have a question from one of our callers and listeners, Brad. Has anyone considered using the reservoirs to replenish the underground aquifers at all? Very interesting question about water supply.
That is an interesting question. It's a great question from Brad, and especially having gone to a water conference with Governor Brownback of Kansas. Kansas is in a two-year drought, especially in the western portion. Right now, and I can't speak to everything that the state of Kansas is doing, but they're looking at some conservation techniques with the Ogallala Reservoir or Ogallala Aquifer in western Kansas. We don't have a lot of reservoirs out there. We've got Wilson and Canopolis Lake. So from the Corps of Engineers perspective, of our 18 lakes, only two are kind of in that area, but we will continue to manage those. But it's a great question, and there's a lot of concern, especially in western Kansas, on those aquifers and if they'll be able to replenish, and if not, what conservation techniques are being put in place. Our role in that is really a support role because we don't have a lot of reservoirs in that area.
Nolan writes in, it used to be that rivers flooded and spilled nutrient-rich silt into the floodplains, which is what made Kansas soil so great for farming. Topsoil is a very important issue for farmers across the country. How can we better incorporate flooding to replenish this very important natural process and natural resource? You just mentioned the two-year drought in Kansas. Here's Nolan asking you that question.
Yeah, Nolan makes a great point. I guess one of the key aspects of the Bank Stabilization Navigation Project is, as we took that longest river in the U.S., as you alluded to earlier, Jabulani, 1,900 miles long, one of our first missions in the Kansas City District was to take that braided meandering river and make it a navigable channel. While that bank stabilization navigation project was built from 1912 to 1981, we actually created 155,000 acres of land that is great farmland right now.
Well, this conversation will keep rolling like the river we're talking about. Colonel Anthony J. Hoffman, commander of the Kansas City District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, is here, as is Judge Kunivan, the Corps' Chief of Emergency Management. Thank you, Colonel, and thank you, Judd, for joining us on Central Standard today.
Thanks, Judge.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
You can find our show's ICAVS podcast, features, and a lot more at kcur.org. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Up to Date is next with psychologist Wes Crenshaw and a discussion on kids home for the holidays. Speaking of kids home, happy birthday, Emerson Roosevelt LaFall. You turned one today. Te amo, hijo del cielo. Daddy loves you. I'm Jabulani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.